Welcome to Beyond the Boundaries, a group relations podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ellen Short, and this is season two of the podcast, and the title and theme of this season is Capturing the Legacy and Future of Group Relations. And for this episode, our guest is Sharla Hayden. Sharla Hayden is a freelance organizational consultant and has been for many, many years. She is a member of the A.K. Rice Institute for the Study of Social Systems, which we also call ACRI, A-K-R-I, and also the West Coast affiliate of ACRI, which is called GREX, acronym G-R-E-X, and she has been in those roles since 1972. She has also been on the board of directors at ACRI and also on the board of GREX. She has been the chair of the ACRI Training and Certification Committee. She has also been a fellow, an ACRI fellow, which is a very distinguished award and role to have in ACRI since 1995. And Sharla, I don't know how many conferences that she has directed, but she's been a conference director, group relations conference director for many conferences for many years, and including ACRI's, what we used to call ACRI's National Conference, which was an annual residential group relations conference. And so I'd like to welcome Sharla Hayden. Sharla, welcome to Beyond the Boundaries.
Thank you.
It's great to have you here. And before we start, I did want to also just talk a little bit about, for transparency and for our listeners, a little bit about how we know each other. And I have to say that the first time that, I mean, I saw your name for many years on conference staffs when I first started in the work, but my first experience of you was when you were directing the ACRI National Conference in Chicago. And then since then, which I have to say was a really, really interesting experience. It was my first residential conference, and it was a very powerful experience for me. And I do remember your directing, and I remember how, I guess I would say, how close I felt that you were to us in terms of how you related to the membership as the director. It was a very interesting experience. And I mean that in a really positive way. And then my other experiences were just working with you on staff for a few conferences, but mostly seeing you at the dialogues and connecting with you there, and also eventually our developing a friendship and a mentoring relationship, in which you have really, really been very, very supportive of me as I have developed my skills as a group relations practitioner and a consultant. And finally, you know, we have developed a friendship, and that is how we know each other. And it's just been a pleasure getting to know you and also working with you as well. I just wanted to put that out there for transparency for our listeners.
That would be true for me too, Ellen. I feel the same way about you.
Thank you, Sharla. I appreciate that. Now, one of the things that I didn't add when I was reading your bio is I wanted to just talk a little bit about three publications that I think are very salient in terms of my experience of your writing. And the first one is the Tavistock Primer 2. And that is authored by Sharla and also Renee Molenkamp. That is in the Group Relations Reader 3, which was published in 2004. And we can post a link for that on our resource page. But what I wanted to say about it is that for those of you who are listening who are interested in a group relations conference, and what is a group relations conference like, and what happens in terms of being a member and the structure, the Tavistock Primer is an excellent chapter for that. The other publication that I think I really found very interesting that I want to name is by you and Bernie Gertler, and that is Uneasy on the Boundary, Reflections on the Culture and Effectiveness of Group Relations Conference Work in the USA, 1965 through 2012. That's the period that you and Bernie are covering with that chapter. And that's in a book called Group Relations Work, Exploring the Impact and Relevance Within and Beyond Its Network. And that book was published in 2015. I think that's one of our, published by Carnac, and I think that book is from our Belgerate conference series.
Yeah.
And so I found that chapter to be very helpful when I was doing some research on sentience in group relations work. And so I wanted to name that. And I think you're going to talk a little bit about conference work in that way today. And then the third chapter, which is such a great title, is The Race Idea Tends to Make People Wicked, An Exploration of Why It Persists. And that is authored by Sharla, and she's the sole author of that chapter. It's I'm biased because it's in my book, but okay. I think it's an excellent chapter, and it's in a book that was edited by Dr. Leo Wilton and myself, and the book is called Talking About Structural Inequalities in Everyday Life, New Politics of Race in Groups, Organizations, and Social Systems. That was published in 2016 and published by Information Age Publishing. It is also available, the book is available on Amazon, and we can provide that information on the resources page as well.
Thank you.
Very welcome. So, you know, one of the first questions that we ask our guests for the podcast is to reflect on and talk about how you were introduced to group relations work and, you know, how you learned about it. And also, once you had the experience of going to a conference, because that's the way most people first experience group relations work, you know, what attracted you? What stayed with you? What resonated with you? So I ask you that, and I'm really interested to hear your reflections, Sharla.
Well, there's kind of a heritage story behind this. Garrett and Lars were brought to UCLA by Jolly West, who was the chair of psychiatry at UCLA. I was working as a personnel person at the VA, which was right across the highway from UCLA. And Jolly and West brought Garrett O'Connor and Lars Lofgren to work in psychiatry at UCLA, but also at the VA system where I was across the freeway. And so they wanted to train other people in thinking as group relations people do, that there is an unconscious level underneath everything that's going on when humans get together. Things we either don't know we're doing or we don't know how to speak to as we're interacting with each other. And they went back to Beyond's theories and they said, hey, go to a conference in Berkeley and see what you think. And so I went to my first conference in Berkeley, California. I don't even remember. I think it was 1970 or something like that. And I was furious at the consultant for not feeding me information about what I was supposed to think or how I was supposed to react. And I was so angry. Phyllis Kempner, a psychologist who lived in that area, was consulting and she wasn't speaking. She wasn't telling us what to do. She was waiting to see what we did, but she infuriated me because she wasn't telling me what I should think or say or do. And so in the second or third session of the study group, I was so infuriated that I convinced four or five other people in this group of 12 to leave the room. I was infuriated because she wasn't teaching us anything. And so we sat downstairs in the library where we were for about, I don't know, 3 hours or something, trying to explore why we left the room. We were so infuriated at her. But finally, I said, well, we're learning nothing here. We're learning zero. We're just learning we were mad.
And yes. So
I started to think about how we could get back in. So we went back upstairs, and I brought a book by who was it? I can't remember who it was. One of the early writers in group relations work in England, or from England. And I put the book. We went in. We went upstairs. The rest of the members had moved our chairs out of the room. They weren't there anymore. They had circled the wagon, so to speak, and we were just coming in because we had left them.
Right.
And they wouldn't let us in. And so we were in a library there. So I pulled a famous book off the shelf, which I don't remember what it was. And I sneaked in front of the consultant, and I got down on my knees, and I put this thing on Phyllis Kempner's lap, this book. And I said, "Would you please let us come back in?" Thinking that she had the authority to choose, but it was not she who sent us out. We were the ones who had taken ourselves out. And so I was kneeling in front of her. Our chairs had been pushed aside. And I realized that I had done this unconsciously because of how I felt. And that was the moment I got interested in group relations. That was the time. So they did finally open the circle and put chairs in. And so we went on. But that was my introduction to group relations work. And I remember thinking, why did Garrett and Lars send me here? Why did they put me in this torture? But I really got it that there's an unconscious that works in groups that gather, whether they're aware of it or not. And I was acting out the frustration and sense of being impoverished because the consultant wasn't saying anything. And so that began my journey in group relations. And that was in the 60s, late 60s sometime. I don't remember exactly. But I was then raised by Garrett and Lars, who didn't tell me how to do anything. They just said, do what we do. Watch us and do what we do. And I did administration for a lot of time in the group relations conferences. And then I was a consultant. And I learned and learned and learned and learned. I mean, those years were absolutely glorious. I had no idea that there was such a thing as an unconscious in human groups.
Very powerful.
It was just stunning to me that I didn't know what was really happening. I was a person who had written a lot of poetry. So it was fascinating.
It is fascinating. And the thing that I really resonate with is what you were speaking about Charla, in relation to what I would describe as the dependency needs, right?
Absolutely.
To have the expectation of being told what to do in the group, and then to realize that the person that you perceive as the leader, which would be the consultant, is not going to tell you what to do. And what I think is so interesting, because I think that people feel this all the time in group relations conferences, people who are less experienced, obviously that was your first experience, people who are more experienced, the feeling still comes up. It just comes up in different ways. And what I like about your narrative is that you express the anger by leaving and then realized that, you know, ultimately you realized that you had, well, actually you took up your authority. You and your colleagues took up your authority to leave, but didn't understand why you were doing it and still attributed it to the consultant's power and authority. I think that is just really fascinating. And it sounds like that is what captured you, you know, intellectually and emotionally, that moment.
That's right. I expected to be nurtured by anybody who was supposed to be teaching me something. And I understood then what conference work is the creation of milieu where you can learn what you learn. And of course, the old timers wanted to talk about authority and leadership and things like that, which I very, very deeply value and have written a lot of work about how they thought. But I really think it's the coming to grips with what you don't know, that is the most shocking thing that I began with.
Yeah, I think that the unknown and what you don't know is very daunting. I mean, to realize, you know, there are many things we don't know, but then to realize that in that very concrete way, I think is really daunting. And I want to connect also with what you said about Garrett. And who was the other person?
Lars Lofgren, a Swede.
Right. Yeah. Garrett and Lars, so often we say to people, just go to the conference. You need to have this experience. But we can't really I'm going to say two things. We can't necessarily describe exactly what's going to happen. But I know as a professor, when I would recommend students go to group relations conferences, I ended up realizing that I did have to tell them something. Like I had to really give them a structure and allow them to fill in whatever their experiences were. Obviously, they're going to do that. But it's really interesting that you were just told to just go.
Right.
And then when you got into the work, they're saying, just do what I do, watch me.
Right.
And did you experience that as being sufficient?
No, I love them both for how much I learned from them. And I'm really sorry that they've passed away, both of them. Garrett died young, I thought, but Lars went back to Sweden. They both went back to the countries they came from to pass. And Lars lived a lot longer. He lived out here in Oregon for a while before they went back to Sweden, et cetera, et cetera. So they've been gone a long time, but they live in me. I didn't want to be like either one of them. You know, Garrett would say really incisive things. He would tell members of the conferences, this is what you're doing. And I didn't want to do that. I wanted to help them explore what was going on. And Lars was very quiet. He was like some kind of one of those statues in Egypt that you think should be speaking but isn't.
The Sphinx? Like a Sphinx?
Yeah. Lars very seldom said a word. But when he did, you listened. And I looked at these two guys and they said to me, well, after the first conference, why don't you be the administrator of a conference? And I said, okay, I'll do that. And then there were various things that happened, like we were locked in a room and blah, 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 the staff. So it was at a big psych hospital in West LA. So I began the journey right then when I was in my late, how old was I? My late, I wasn't 40 yet. It was in my late 30s or my mid, no, it was earlier. It was in my late 20s. Anyway, many years ago. And they opened my mind to open it. Do you know? I mean, I began to say, and that's why some of the things I've written recently are, you have to wonder. You have to wonder what we're all about. You know, what are we as humans doing in this milieu called Earth? And wherever the specific location is that our bodies are put, it's been an amazing ride.
Yeah, I really appreciate what you're saying about the fact that Lars and Garrett live within you, because I do think that a lot of our colleagues that we have experienced in a mentoring way, however sufficient or insufficient that mentoring might have been, they do live within us. We've learned from them.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really a lovely way of thinking about it, even though the feelings may not always be so lovely.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
And the wondering, can you say a little bit more about the wondering piece that you mentioned?
That came to me later because of certain things. You know, the Vietnam War was coming along at that point. And that was fascinating. We had a lot of veterans coming back from Vietnam to be treated or to live in the psych hospital. And it was just, while they were hopefully repairing themselves, their psyches, we didn't have a physical hospital. They had to go over to UCLA if they were injured. But so many men came back that had been injured psychologically, and they came to Brentwood, which was the psych hospital. And Lars and Garrett designed these amazing groups where people could talk to each other about their experiences in Vietnam and they thought I had talent already. I have no clue why they thought that. But they had me go and sit in on a lot of the, and there was another person, I've forgotten his name, Jeffrey something. They sent us out to see how the groups were doing because there were bunches of many returning Vietnam vets. And we were to help them, the facilitators who were there, because they had to take their own facilitator. Garrett and Lars were very smart about taking up your own authority to contribute. And Jeffrey Tropp and I were just two of the people who went out and worked with them, the ones who were facilitating.
Right. It's
absolutely fascinating to see how war could be less horrible over time if you really understood what had happened. And so we made no political statements. We just helped groups facilitate with their people, their own people, but we helped a lot. We did large groups. We did groups on the units to help people try to see what they were feeling more carefully and why this had happened. And of course, Vietnam turned out to be a horrible experience, but we felt we were helping support them take back their own leadership because they felt they had been done to. You know, my brother got some kind of a tooth thing in his mouth, so he wasn't sent to Vietnam. Otherwise, he would have been there in a nanosecond. And my father was ashamed of him, of my brother, for not going to war because he had been a Marine for 20 years. Anyway, the war was still in them when they came home, and many of them had been upset. And so we had to organize these groups. And they asked for me to train some of the people that were vets to help the groups that they were organizing on their own units. And this other person and I would go around and see how they were doing. And it was an amazing observation to see that they could heal themselves with each other. The wounded psychologically didn't have to be helped by somebody who knew better, who never went to the war, but a person who could help them explore their shared experience in Vietnam was so magical.
Yeah, I think as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking about what I read later in my experience of doing group work when I was writing a paper about Wilfred Bion and really understanding that he experienced Wilfred Bion, by the way, for our listeners, was a British psychiatrist who created what we now call what he called then the basic assumption model for group facilitation, group consultation, group behavior, and we will put some information about Wilfred Bion and some of his publications on our resource site. But he is one of the foundational theorists of group relations work. And one of the things that I didn't realize, because I wasn't taught early on, was that he was traumatized.
Right.
And you were talking about, he was traumatized from his war experiences, I think World War I.
Yes.
And you are talking about the trauma that the Vietnam veterans experienced. And one of the things that was so powerful to me in Bion's theorizing and writing that I learned was, you know, this idea of finding a good enough or sufficient container to manage some of the trauma that he had experienced. And that's what I experienced in this moment, you saying about the work that you and Garrett and Lars and your other colleague and others that you work with were doing with those Vietnam veterans, and they needed it. And they were also they were helping each other to contain.
That's right.
As well. Is that an accurate interpretation?
Yes, and I will say that I had the good fortune of being the president of Grex at the time Bion was living in Southern California, which wasn't very long. He was there to do something which I can't remember. But I had the honor of introducing him twice in auditoriums at UCLA, and I said to him, he was the most fascinating man. I said to him, would you like me to introduce you? And if so, what would you like me to say? And he said, he was very tall. He was like 6 feet four or something. And he said, whatever you wish.
Interesting.
I realized that that's who he was, that he wasn't going to comment on anything unless he felt he had something of value to say. And so I introduced him twice in auditoriums at the UCLA over and the NPI, the Neuropsychiatric Institute. And it was fascinating to introduce him because when he spoke, he had interesting things to say, and he didn't say a word for like minutes in between.
Wow.
And everybody in the audience was really nervous, and I was nervous. I thought, he's just standing there. He never sat down to speak. He was standing up, and he would leave long minutes in between. And I thought to myself, why does he not say more? And I realized that what he was saying was so deep and so piercingly real that you had to take a few minutes in between his comments and really digest them, or else if he said it all quickly, boom, 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 you'd miss it. And so I was fascinating. I got to introduce him twice during the time he was there. And he was the most unusual human I think I've ever met.
That is so interesting. And I think that that is really cool, for lack of a better word, that you met him.
It was cool.
And, you know, engaged with him a bit and introduced him twice, because a lot of our primary foundational theorists and group relations practitioners, you know, when I came into the work in the late 90s, they were gone, right? And so I think it's interesting. I think it's cool. I think it's important that you share that you did meet him and have the experience of him, because a lot of art, especially in psychology, many of the theorists, most of the theorists that I studied are no longer with us. Yeah. So thank you for sharing that. And I wanted to ask you, did you have something else you wanted to add?
I want to say one more thing. Elliot Jacks, another Englishman, came and taught at USC a few times, and I got to take a class from him, Elliot Jacks, who wrote a big book about, you know, work systems and all the dynamics of that. And he became a more accessible hero because I could raise my hand in the classroom where he was and ask him things, and he would respond. And of course, Beyond didn't operate that way. So Elliot Jacks was a visiting professor at USC a couple of times. And it was fascinating to listen to him. I mean, he had a more applied view. You know, Beyond was more, he knew the unconscious was out there and he was trying to understand it. Elliot Jacks was a student of his actually for a while somewhere. I don't remember if it was abroad or here somewhere. But he, Elliot Jacks, had much more. He took Beyond's theory and applied it to work systems. And so his work was really important too.
Yeah, you sent me some of his work, and I didn't know he was that connected to Beyond. But yes, I'm only familiar with it through what you have shared with me so generously. So that sounds interesting. And he does sound like he was more accessible.
Yes.
To you.
Yes, he was about real organizations.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask you, in addition to some of the people that you've named, this is my next question. Are there others, significant group relations mentors or colleagues that you have learned from?
You know, I would hesitate to point out anyone in particular because I just kept learning. I mean, I did this work for how many years? I mean, how old am I? I learned from everybody I ever worked with. I mean, I just felt like even if we didn't like each other, even if we were working on different thematic issues around what was going on in the membership that was there, I had learned about boundaries. I learned about boundaries, authority, role, and task.
Right,
and,
right.
I knew how to examine what was going on in conference work. I did a lot of national conferences on the East Coast, and I did a lot in Chicago. I did some in Northern California. I did a bunch in Southern California. I directed a lot of conferences, and I tried to have a stance that was not leaderly, but welcoming. And sometimes, and this is what Bion said, sometimes, you know, it's like, well, here we are. And here we are, I think he said the second time at UCLA. And I tried to not, when I was directing conferences later on in my career, I thought, why tell people what they're supposed to learn? Why tell them? And so more recent conferences, which have a theme of something, I think, wait a minute, you're controlling what people focus on, when in fact the human unconscious, especially in groups, is extremely wide. And so I've been sort of a naysayer with regard to thematic conferences, unless you've already had a classic conference where you learn how to learn about the unconscious. And so I have had more about, let's see here, I would say I've had more conferences that were what I call naked, meaning no theme, although I have done some theme conferences, but I always felt constrained because I felt like you have to really be with the here and now and be working on it.
So you said a couple things that I really want to zoom in on. And so the first one is BART. And I want to say to our listeners who may not know what BART is, you did already say boundaries, authority, role, and task.
Right.
And that is a template or a model for working with organizations and working with systems that one can use. Can you say a little bit more about that? Because I know you also have a really interesting twist on BART right. that you have shared with me in mentoring me around consultation. So please share your thoughts about BART.
You know, I have to say that my memory is dim about how I came up with BART. I don't know if it was in a group. I don't know if it was me. It came along a long time ago. But as you say, more recently, I wanted to really look at the container, so to speak, of a conference, like, why are people here? Why are the consultants here to help them learn, et cetera? And so I changed the boundaries, authority, role, and task to be task, role, authority, and boundaries, TRAB, which is kind of not so easy to roll off the tongue. And people have joked about BART when I wrote that first essay. And they joke, well, so have you seen BART recently?
Right.
I was ridiculed for coming up with these ideas. But it was because I took those courses from Elliot Jacks, who visited twice in Southern California, so I could hear him. And I thought, well, why do it, BART? The truth is you have a task, you have authority to take up, then you have a role in it. And then you have to do the task. So it's like, that's it. Task, authority, role, and what's the last one? I can't remember it.
Well, you said TRAB. So task, role, authority. It's TRAB, right? Not TRAP.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah,
so it's so just to be clear for me, because I know I did use it in one of the consultations and it was really helpful.
Yeah.
TRAB.
Yes.
Right?
Boundaries
so,
is last. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Boundaries is last.
Authority and boundaries. That's right.
Yeah.
I've forgotten what I invented.
That's okay. I just wanted you to speak on it for a little bit, just for our listeners. And I'm still thinking about it. And I think about it both ways now, that you offered that to me, and it's really interesting. And there may be more innovations on that in the future. So it's something to really hold on to.
I can say just a bit about that if we have time. It seemed to me, because I started to be a consultant in the broader world when I was probably 30-ish, and I thought to myself, because I had looked at all the materials and I had written some work already, and I did some work at a religious group that that met in San Diego every year. They were monks. All of them were male. And I went down there with Tom Kohler, who is a psychologist friend of mine, and then later on with Ron Sharon, and we had large groups with them. They didn't want to do small groups. They just wanted their community of they were mostly what we called monks, but I think they have other names now. But they would come together, and they found out that we knew something about collective groups. And so they started inviting us to come down there, I think in the late 70s. And we did that for many, many, many years. And then Tom Kohler died and he stopped doing it. And then Ron Sharon went down there with me and did it for years. It was really interesting to be among people of the cloth, to see about the idea about your belief system as opposed to group relations, which was not really a religion. I mean, some people have talked about group relations work as religious, and I've done work in religious systems in organizations, etc. Mm-hmm. But the group relations is not a religion, in spite of how it's been characterized by some people. It's really about curiosity.
Yes,
it's a seeking function to come to a conference and see how you are, how they are, and how we are. You know, and it's a fascinating experience. And I did directing in a lot of places for many years, and then I stepped out, I don't know what, 20 years ago maybe, because I felt other people needed to take the reins for directorship. And so I stepped out. Although I continued to write papers for many years, and I have one right now in process.
I know, and we're gonna talk a little bit about that later on in the interview. But I want to connect with you about what I said earlier about my experience of you as a director at the National Conference is exactly what you spoke about. I think that you created in your leadership a system, a temporary institution system, whatever we want to call it, of being curious, of wondering, of being a leader that was accessible in ways that I had not previously seen or experienced at group relations conferences. And I was fascinated by it. And I remember there was a moment in the IE that always stays with me, where I was part of an IE group, or maybe it was the IG. I can't remember at this point, but in any case, I was part of a group of what we were considered then as younger group relations, members, right? And we had wanted to come to the staff room to meet with the staff. And we were sent away by one of your staff members. And what I remember is that word came to us that you were just really upset about that and really didn't like the fact that we had been turned away, and you really wanted to engage with us. And it was remedied, and the engagement happened. But I just remember thinking, wow, you know, what a way to take up your authority. The curiosity that you had about what we'd wanted to say, even though it was a boundary issue, the turning away was a boundary issue, or maybe we hadn't expressed ourselves properly, you know, with the rules of engagement at the door. But it was really meaningful to me to have that happen. And I always think about that in terms of your leadership and what you just talked about.
Yeah. Well, the question I always have when I was directing really was, why am I doing this? And the why I'm doing this isn't because I want to be famous or better than or whatever. is to give people the opportunity I had when I was going to conferences as a member, because I began to see all the conferences I went to as a big laboratory. I could learn so much about me. I could learn so much about the people in the small group. At first in a large group, I was terrified. I mean, everywhere in my later time after I was trained, even I was in a large group in New York at NYU. There were 90 people in the room, and the
wow,
and there were, you couldn't breathe in there. The circles were, and you couldn't breathe. And somebody said, "Well, let's push a few people out of the window," because it was heavy. You know, there was no air conditioning. It was summer, and there were, I think, about 90 of us in the, and there was about to be a riot because it was so hot in there. And then the group started fantasizing, well, we can dump a few out the window. It was three stories off the ground. And I thought, no, we can't do that. And I was, as one of the consultants, there were three of us, I was about to stand up and say, that will not happen here. When one of the officers, I think they were from West Point, there were four of them in this group, he stood up and said, stop this nonsense. And I thought, we have somebody who knows how to use his authority in the room of 90 people. I said, wow, this guy knows what to do.
Yes, yes.
Because I was about to stand up and say, shut up and be calm. What I was supposed to say. And I was a fairly experienced consultant by then. But he did it. He did what was necessary. And then later on, I pointed it out to people in discussion groups, not there. But he did what was needed. And I've seen other groups try to attack each other when small groups got together. There was a scene in one, I think this was in California somewhere. One guy took a knife. He was arguing with somebody and he took a knife out of his holster and on his belt. And the other guy who was hammering at him said, what do you want to do? Do you want to fight? You want to fight? And the guy said, yes. And he showed his knife.
Oh, my goodness.
And so it was the only time that I needed to stand up and say, stop this nonsense. We need to look at what's happening, because if there's any harm done here to people, we will all be responsible for it. I was trying to get them to see the collective dynamic that was going on. If all of us, including me as the consultant, let that happen.
Of course,
and
yes.
I stopped it. And then we just went into application mode and talked about what had happened and why.
That's very powerful. I don't think I've ever been at conferences with a great deal of aggression, but that was a very concrete expression of it. And obviously there were dynamics going on with people being filled up with it, and male people in particular in that case. Really interesting scenarios and experiences that you've had at conferences in your leadership role as a member as well. And so I want to move into something that I know is very meaningful to you, and I think it might be helpful for our listeners. Can you talk about your feelings about, you've already mentioned it, but really, you know, elaborate about what you mean by classic conferences?
I mean conferences that aren't named to focus on something in particular, like gender, race, countries of origin. I mean, various conference directors have decided to make specialty conferences go, focus on one element of the human experience. I think some of those are fine. I mean, I don't go along with the thematic. I think thematic conferences are good if you've been to the first kind that's like how it was, you know, the general way to learn in a conference. And I have to say that I went to, as a member, I went to four or five conferences before I felt like maybe, and then I got to be an administrator with Lars and Garrett, blah, 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 in California. So I felt like it took a long time to really grasp what was going on. I mean, I was a poet, you know, I was an English major in school, blah, blah, blah. What did I know? And so, So I had to feel like I knew something before I could be a consultant. And I don't know, I think I'm drifting away from your question, but I feel like...
No, you've answered it. You've answered it. I mean, because I've heard you talk about this before, but I think it is interesting for the interview to discuss it further, and you have written about it and you've presented about it as well. Mm-hmm. And so I want to engage with you on this because it's an interesting dynamic for me, because I guess I did initially attend what you would describe as classic conferences when I first started as a member, because my background is coming from Northwestern University and attending my first conference that was directed by Sunny Citrinbaum in the class, you know, in the course, right?
Right.
So my concerns were very different than they were in my later membership experiences, because I was writing, I was, my motivation for attending that first conference was quite different.
Yeah.
And so then I attended a few after. And so I guess my point is, I do understand about the classic. It's not a disagreement, but what I do feel that, and I've shared this with you, but what I do feel about that designation for those types of conferences is that there are things, I think the thematic conferences started to happen because there are things that happen in the quote unquote classic conferences that are potentially disturbing and sometimes harmful to people, for example, from marginalized groups, to people who may or may not have an understanding of the unconscious, as you were talking about before, of not knowing really about the unconscious. And I think that the reason, and there are many opinions about this, and I could be completely wrong about it, but my feeling is that the reason that the thematic conferences started to happen was to correct that. I'm not saying that that's what was accomplished, mm-hmm. but that, when I say correct that, I mean correct some of the racism, some of the sexism, some of the homophobia, some of the xenophobia, and, you know, just all kinds of isms that we have in group relations work based on the origins of group relations work, which tend to be British and American, colonial, and in some ways white supremacist based, right? And so that is what I think happened in my humble opinion with the development and the holding of group relations conferences, designing, et cetera, that are related to identity, because it wasn't being dealt with. And the last thing I will say about that, I feel like it wasn't being, when I say it wasn't being dealt with, Sharla, I mean, when I first entered group relations work, I felt that people were acting as if, which is interesting, which is, we say that a lot in our work, as if Beyond didn't have a culture, as if Beyond didn't have a race and a gender and, you know, a colonial background, for example, as if Margaret Riok didn't have the cultural intersectionality that she has. And the classic is also embedded in cultural context, and that was never acknowledged when I entered into the work. So I just wanted to say that to you, and I want to get your thoughts.
Well, I agree with you. I think I've told you this before. What I began to think was, especially in universities that are offering group relations as a way of learning about systems, is that you need to have a classic conference first. Excuse me. You need to have a classic conference first so that then you can go to the focused conferences. Because I remember how drift I was when I went to my first conference. I had no idea what to do or say. Well, I told you the original one. I think that it's better to be confronted with the method of learning than it is the content. And I remember at first being only focused on classic, the classic conference. Later on, I did some other conference. I tried to do a conference focused on post-war, post-Vietnam War. Nobody came. I tried to do a conference about death and dying. Nobody came. I mean, there were several conferences. The year that Barack Obama was entering the presidency, I had to cancel, and Janice Wagner was really mad at me. But I didn't want to try to have enough people at a conference when Obama was being installed as the president. I mean, I just thought, so I canceled that conference, and that was because I didn't think people would come, and I thought it was more important to have the inauguration of a Black president, more important than doing a conference. And I didn't think anybody could really pay attention to the conference, and Janice and I had a little tiff about that, but the Boston Center lost money, which I felt bad about, but I didn't have enough money to fund it back. So anyway, I think a good classic conference is a way of learning, meaning no theme. After that, if you learn how to learn in a conference, then all bets are off, race, gender, you know, whatever. I think a few people who've done conferences with thematic underpinnings are going way too fancy for me. I still think the method of learning is what I'm so interested in, is how do people learn about their unconscious and the collective unconscious of everybody who's there. I mean, I just think it's fascinating.
I hear that, and I'm appreciative of what you're saying, and actually don't disagree. I think that maybe sometimes what comes up for me is that maybe in the conferences that are about power and authority and classic in the way that you're describing them, maybe what we really need is to have staff that is more competent around cultural issues in those conferences as well as the thematic conferences. What do you think about that?
Well, what I think about it is that if you, whatever race you've come through to be a human born on the planet, is you have to be, I had an interesting childhood because I lived all over the place. My father was a pilot in the Marine Corps, so I didn't have a home. I was born in Dallas in World War II, but I lived in Hawaii. I lived in Florida twice. I lived in North Carolina. I lived in Nebraska. Where else did I live? I never had a home, and that was very helpful. I mean, my brother suffered because he was a year and a half younger. He is a year and a half younger, and it was really hard for him, but it made me a really good observer of different folks, you know, of people's races, of people's ages, of people's cultures. You know, I fell in love with a Hawaiian boy when we lived on Oahu. I mean, it's like the childhood I had was very fortunate, even though I never had a home until I was in high school. But I love that. I felt like so lucky. My brother suffered from it, but I wasn't. So I do think one has to check one's, one's unconscious discriminatory veins, and then bring it forward and maybe even talk about the person or persons who are, you and I've talked about being Black and white a bit. It's like, why shouldn't we talk about it? Why shouldn't we understand more about each other?
Right.
I wish it weren't a forbidden topic.
Well, that is what I wish as well. But I also think the nature of our work really, in an ideal context, should be able to support those types of conversations.
Me too.
And that type of exploration.
Me too.
And, you know, I did not find that until I started attending themed conferences.
Right. Right.
And so that's, I kind of feel like even though I had non-themed conferences of, you know, including, you know, in Sunny's class, which was the beginning of everything for me, mm-hmm. even though I had those experiences, I really feel like how should I say this? I really feel like almost I was raised on the themed conferences, that I began to really come alive in the work, and the work began to mean something for me more profoundly in the themed conferences, because I felt a freedom there that I didn't feel in the other conferences. But this is where I agree with you. I had a very strong foundation from the course in graduate school and from those other conferences around theory and understanding group relations. And so I was able to sort of bounce off of that foundation and explore. This is what I like. This is not what I like. This is what I need, you know, that type of thing. And so I'm with you on that.
Well, I don't know if you were ever at a conference where I did a prequel, which was I offered a 1 or 2 hour session for the members who were going to come to talk about the nature of the learning as it had been designed. Because so many people feel, and I felt this too, I was enraged. You know, I walked out of the room and took 4 other people with. I think, you know, the outrage of the first experience without being led, you know, when you're not being led by anybody, and there you are with a bunch of strangers, and what's going on here? You're supposed to teach me. And so, you know, that original thing is like, my dependency just welled up in me. It was like, what? You're supposed to teach me something. And, you know, then finally we went back and blah, and then I got really involved in group relations. But I do think it's good to have people have a prequel, which is like a course, or even an hour or two to come and talk with the director before the conference starts, so they can understand that they are being held well, but not in a way they've known before.
No, I agree with you. And it really calls to mind that we are doing that in ACRI now. And I think GRI members also certainly can participate. And, you know, Sarah Rosenbaum has a course that she leads that is focused on those issues that we're talking about to enhance knowledge of group relations context and theory. And that is something that is happening. So I totally agree with you.
Right.
And I want to segue now into the next question, which is, I wanted to ask you if you could describe, and I think you've already done it a little bit, but if you could describe what group relations work means to you now, personally and professionally.
Well, I took, when I was really kind of a budding group relations consultant, I took on some contracts in California when I still lived in Southern California. And I remember going with one of the psychiatry residents, because somebody up in a county in the midsection of California needed some consultation, because teens and the police in this county were fighting with each other. There were street fights. Now, that's kind of weird. It was an agricultural area of sort of central northern California. And we went up there to see what we could do. We were just fledgling consultants. And what we learned was the magic of listening. If we just told them what they ought to do, we realized, I think it was Jeff Tropp, we realized that if we just told them how to get out of this fight they were in, then they would learn nothing. We'd give them a recipe or something. And so that's when I really got what group relations is about, is to hold the system as it looks at itself. And so from that first consultation, which, you know, Garrett Lars didn't teach me anything about that, but I remembered what works best is to stay silent until you really have something to say that you think is cogent. And so that little ditty, which was many zillions of years ago, and whoever it was, I think it was one of the psych residents, we came back learning a huge amount, is that listening to your clients, listening, and only intervening when you feel you can help them learn more. And so that's been sort of my principle underneath group relations, is not to tell any groups but to say, and that's why I've written these papers about wonder. I wonder what's going on. I wonder why that happened. I wonder. So it's not a directorial job. It's a holding job to help people wonder about what's going on. That's why that's been my theme of late.
I think that is so interesting and really powerful, because for a couple of reasons, it reminds me of my training, my clinical training, and having to become an active listener, and how we think that we are actually listening when we are not. And then, you know, I went on to teach, and how I had to teach my students, particularly in the context of listening to clients, mm-hmm. to really be listening. Mm-hmm. But it also, you know, Sharla, makes me think about how you have transformed your work in terms of being more active in group relations conferences, becoming less active, but you have this wealth of knowledge, and you're questioning, it seems like to me, you're questioning all the time yourself, and you're in a state of wondering, and you are now, and you correct me if I'm wrong, but I just feel like you are now personally and professionally exploring those realms in your writing, in your consultation work. Mm-hmm. I certainly have experienced it in your mentoring of me to do my consultation work. And I know you mentor others as well. And so I think you are really, it just sounds like a very rich state of being that you're in right now. What would you say?
Yeah, it's kind of second nature to me just to wonder. I can't, I'm reading a novel or two, or I'm reading a book about the American system of governance, wondering if it can ever survive in the long term. I really, as you know, I have a war with capitalism. I really think that this country has been taken over by how much money you have, or how big a house you have, or what have you. And I think to myself, do you believe in death after you die? I mean, do you believe in life after you die? Because if you do, maybe you feel fine. I don't. I'm pretty sure when I'm dead, I'm dead. And so what I'm doing here in this lifetime is to try to be helpful, supportive, kind, and to love the people I love, overtly, to make it real, to say that they know that I love them. So it's like, what else is there for humans to do?
Yes. Yeah. I hear you, and certainly have experienced that from you. And we're winding down towards the end of the interview, but I have two things that I wanted to ask you to speak on. Just a little bit of a description briefly about what you think the future holds for group work, or what it should hold for group relations work. And then I want you to talk about your projects, any projects that you're working on. Mm-hmm. And let's stick with the future and group relations work, if you have any thoughts about that.
I think there's hope, actually. I mean, some of the conferences that I read about, because I get the advertisements for what's happening, I think there's a bit of a return to what I call the classic, which is, let's make sure people know what they're coming for, not the specifics, but what they're coming for, which is to learn how to learn, right, about groups of people and systems of people. So I think there's a renewal of that sort of classic way of thinking. Come to explore what's going on, basically, in the here and now. I do think about the application work, because what I've done a lot of is consulting with systems. I've done it abroad. I've done it here in different states. I've done it in issues of race in different systems. I've really enjoyed it. I sometimes think about writing more. Right now I'm writing an article about Trump, because I think that he's representing a deviance in this country that has to do with materialism. And I think I'm writing this essay about him because he's a fall guy for capitalism in this country. And I think it's not that I think we should go to a socialist structure right away, but it's people want money and things instead of spiritual connections. And I think no matter what your religious background is or your faith system, but I hope Trump gets tromped for sure. I hope he spends the rest of his life in jail.
Mm-hmm. Well, can you sort of elaborate on why you decided to write this article about Donald Trump and about capitalism?
It's very sad. I think that I got onto that track because of what he represents. And so, as you know, I've started writing this article about him. And why has ownership of means, not the purpose? You know, what's the purpose of money? You know, what do you do with money if you don't need it for food and shelter? What do you do with it? And in this country, unfortunately, and I'm afraid there was this guy in Northern California whose name I don't remember, but he was a congressman in California. And he went for this. And so the articles, the book called Me and a bunch of other articles were about how Americans were becoming more self-centered. And it's just appalling to me because I don't have a religion, as you know, but I do have a sense of having faith in our species. You know, maybe we can stop killing the planet. Maybe we can do better. Maybe we can stop eating meat. As you know, I'm a vegetarian.
Yes, but, yes.
But yeah, I think we may have a future on the planet. I do worry about it, mostly for my grandkids now, because I don't think the planet's going to die right away. But I also worry. And if you look at all the new ways that the weather is creating different patterns, it's pretty interesting.
It's interesting. It's daunting. It's a little frightening. Yeah. All of those things. And so when do you anticipate publishing your newest paper? And where can we find it
that's a good question. I don't know how long it will take. I can't tell whether I'm waiting to find out what Trump's ultimate end is, famous and worshipped and getting lots of money. I don't know when that will happen. I'm kind of interested in waiting till the denouement, the thing that happens at the end, or, you know, waiting till the article is fully fleshed out with what damage he's done and why he's so followed. I mean, he's like a god to some people. It's like, what? So I'm ambivalent about it, whether I should finish the article and just publish it already or publish it would be to send it to A.K. Rice. And I don't remember when the next meeting is. It's not until, 2000 and...
You're talking about the dialogues?
Yeah, the dialogues.
The dialogues is next April, 2024.
Yeah, that's right. So I may not finish it until then because I think we will know what his fate has been by then. At least I hope so.
I have a suggestion that I think, first of all, it's a good idea to maybe present it at the dialogues and see what reception you get. And it may also foster some creative ideas for you with regard to finishing it or adding to it. Mm-hmm. But the other thing that occurs to me as you're speaking about it is not to wait until, you know, things are settled, whichever way they're going to be settled with Donald Trump. I think it might be interesting to finish it and then do another article after. You know, like a part two?
Yeah.
And then you can free yourself of that first part and then really immerse yourself in whatever is to come.
Right.
You know, just a suggestion, actually.
Well, I hear you. I think, you know, omnivorant is the name for him. I mean, the description, he'll eat anybody, you know, and he doesn't care. He doesn't care who he digests in his struggle to be king or whatever. So yeah, so I am thinking about finishing it, but I'd like to find out what happens to it before I finish the paper.
I mean, I certainly look forward to reading it. And I think our listeners, people who are listening to this podcast, might look forward to reading it. And I think sharing it with, our members and colleagues at the Dialogues is a terrific idea.
Yeah.
So thank you for speaking about it. And I wanted to move into the final question.
Okay.
Which is to ask you if you have a descriptive metaphor that you would use to describe your relationship with group relations work.
I feel a lot of affection for it, and I want it to proceed. I've had several people who are I've mentored about 11 people who could qualify to be authorized as consultants. I don't know what's going to happen with that authorizing process. It seems to be in flux, but I've mentored several people. I've done it well and fully. And unfortunately, I'm afraid some of us more experienced people have sort of signed off and said, oh, you're ready, go ahead. I don't believe in that, because I believe that group relations is a very fine art where you don't have your own destructive impulses mixed up in it. Like you get tired of the mentee, or you don't want to talk this week, or, you know, whatever it is. I think you have to, it's like growing something. It's like an attitude about understanding groups and humans when they get together to do things. It's not easy right away. And I think the fact that I never had a home and I was raised in the military and all of that stuff has been good for me, because I never lived in the same house until I was in high school. And I got to see lots of different cultural zones and lots of different experiences. And I just feel like that has been an extremely great platform for me to think from and to value. So yeah, I don't have a home. I never had a home. It's a weird thing, because most Americans think they want to have a home. I would say not having a home and traveling all over is also a preparation for an interesting life.
Oh, I would agree with that. Would you say that group relations work in any way has provided you with a home?
Yes, you know, I really, when I first went to a conference and I was so furious at the consultant, and the day went on, and driving back down to Southern California from San Francisco, actually it was in Berkeley, driving down with another person, I began to think, this is where I belong. Not the physical place.
Right.
But the place where you can learn in, you can scrutinize yourself, you can scrutinize others, you can figure out why you do what you do and why they do what they do, and whether you want to go along with it or you want to bail out, or, you know, so I think I was a very quiet child and wrote a lot of poetry and just watched what was going on. So being an organizational consultant or being a group relations person sort of came natural to me.
That makes a lot of sense to me, because I have often thought about the fact that, at least in the United States anyway, we don't have a home, like a actual concrete home for our work, but that this is my feeling, that we create it within the work, and that we create it with our narratives about the work, because I think we're endlessly at our dialogues meetings and the other meetings, we're endlessly talking about what we do. And it just always has felt like a home. That is the way that we create our home.
Yeah.
And I think it's particularly interesting, Sharla, because we are now in an era where there's so much that can be held outside of a concrete destination with regard to technology, for example.
Right.
And that, I don't think that was ACRI's intention to be that way, but I think we we fit into that. Mm-hmm. Now, but I really like what you said about knowing immediately that you had found your place in the work. So I really appreciate that. And I wanted to say one more thing that really came up for me that you didn't say when you were, I'm circling back to the very beginning when I asked you about your narrative, about your first group relations conference experience. You were angry.
Yeah, I was.
When you stood up and you left, but what you, I think, left out is that you were a leader in that moment. You led, you took, first of all, you were self-authorized, as we say in the work, right? You authorized yourself.
Right.
And then four other people followed you out of the small group experience,
right?
And so you were also, even though you didn't know it, you know now, you were taking up your leadership.
Right.
And I think that's really interesting.
Well, I can tell you why I think that's so. My mother was 18 when I was born. The World War II was still going on. My mother had no business having a child. You know, she was a child. And then my brother came along a year and a half later, right at the end of World War II. And he sort of got short shrift too from mothering. My mother was not much of a mother, except that she was not racist, which was totally amazing to be born in Texas. She was born there in 1925. She had a German father, of all things, and who committed suicide, blah, blah, blah. But my mother basically was unformed until she was about 30. Let's see, how would I say? She was gorgeous, beautiful person in her visage. But she was uneducated. She had dropped out of school to marry my father, who was this handsome Marine. And she didn't know how to raise a child. She didn't know. She was 18 when I was born. Then my brother came along when she was 19. She didn't know how to be a parent, which for me was extremely useful.
Right.
I could parent myself. I used to try to catch wild horses in Hawaii, and I used to do this and I used to do that. And she didn't care. She wasn't a smothering mother. In fact, I don't even think she knew where I was half the time. But I think the good news about that was she trusted me.
That absolutely, it's interesting that I think that's absolutely my experience of listening to what you're saying, that she trusted you and that developed something in you around taking up your own authority and trusting yourself and taking up your leadership and also being able to be a follower as well. So I thank you for sharing that. And I also feel like we're coming to a close for the interview.
Yeah, but let's keep talking when we can.
Well, you know, of course we will. And I want to acknowledge the conversation that we've had today. It's been so interesting. And I so appreciate how much you have shared of yourself with me and then ultimately with our listeners and with Manny, our producer as well. You know, I'm always interested in things that you have to say, and I always learn from you, even in the most casual of conversations. You are never boring.
Oh, good.
And no, not to me. And it's also been a pleasure, as always, to just connect with you. I have so much respect for you, and I admire you, and I appreciate that you think of me as a friend as well as a colleague, and I feel the same about you.
Totally true.
And so much affection as well.
Absolutely. Totally true.
Thank you, Sharla.
Thank you.
Beyond the Boundaries is a group relations podcast, and it was produced and edited by Emmanuel Manny Molin, and it is a Group Relations International production. Beyond the Boundaries can be found on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, and Group Relations International's website, which is www.grouprelations.org. Thank you for listening.